Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
This week, on a special bonus episode of Meet & Three, we find out how Brexit could be changing the way that Brits eat.
If you're not getting your food from the European Union, where Britain gets 30% directly, well, where are you going to get it from? As I put very succinctly, bye-bye fresh peaches from Italy, hello tinned peaches from Florida. Bye-bye fresh oranges, hello tinned oranges. Bye-bye free-range beef, hello hormone-injected beef.
Tune in to hear about the UK's struggle to stabilize its food system on Meet & Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one of your hosts, Darren Bresnitz. We are really excited to be sitting down with Ari, Joe, and Adam, three of the four people behind East Hollywood's Found Oyster. It's one of our new favorite restaurants in L.A. It's a great place to get oysters, lobster rolls, natural wine, hang out, see the disco ball, relax. It's a really great story of family and oysters and everything that comes in putting a new restaurant together in L.A. Then we go deep into the archives to 2017 to hang out with the Winstons, a Brooklyn by way of Virginia garage soul duo. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes. Just to find my will.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one of your hosts, Darren Bresnitz. We are here with Joe, Ari, and Adam, the GMs, chef partners, and partners, all respectively laid out. Just go back and do the math. A found oyster. Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, you've only been open for a few months.
Yeah.
And for those who have not had the chance to belly up to the bar for some bivalves, what is found oyster?
You know, I think it's already becoming a lot of things to a lot of people, and that was kind of the intention for the beginning is, you know, my partner Holly and I have last word, and we've been around 5.5 years, and the spaces we've always enjoyed the most when we travel are bars with food, right? And it's one of those things where you're able to gain a sense of intimacy and casualness because being in a bar, you sit high, and there's just a sense of, like, you're supposed to be there to have fun. Fine, we'll go to bars. But we love to eat, and, like, we don't always just go out to drink cocktails, so having spaces where you could go out, have a great bite of something delicious, and be in a bar environment was really important to us from the very beginning. When we signed this lease, which was in August of 18, the vision was an oyster bar, right? Like, what the skin and look and feel and color and everything about that came as we went. And, you know, during the design process, it was just Holly and I. We did not hire designers. And we knew we wanted to build a space that was integrated kind of front and back of house, where you sat down at a bar and your bartender was shucking oysters, where back of house employees would be in a tip pool, and where we would eliminate basically what we call the front of house brigade. So no runners, no busters, and no hosts, right? From there, the concept really evolved with these guys, right? Like, we first started talking to Joe, and I went out and met his mom and dad on Cape Cod, and, like, went to the oyster farm. And we started being like, well, listen, there's got to be, like, this element of Cape Cod involved in here. I grew up in Massachusetts, and so we kind of talked a lot about that. And Joe had worked with my wife, Leah, at Dusty and Novell previously.
Shout out.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's when, like, we really started getting, like, heavy on, like, hey, you know what, maybe we'll find a way to get East Coast oysters out here and focus on a smaller amount of varietals, and we'll really focus on farmers, right? The same way we've seen with food, but really in the oyster sphere. Not just where are they from, but who is actually growing these oysters. And then, really, the final part, which really created Found, was Ari. And we had done some consulting work with him at Hayden and started talking about this project, and really just thought his food and touch and talent and eye for every part of what makes a restaurant great would really finalize what this place could be. And that's really how it turned out. So when Ari came on, you know, we still hadn't, like, picked colors in here. Like, you know, like, we basically just built the place to work. And then, like, sure, as Joe and Ari came in, like, we would go vintage shopping and fill in more and more stuff. We hired a color consultant to help us pick colors, right? Mm. Like, it was all really organic. And I think the concept really got to a place where it was like, hey, you can walk in, you can be in a casual environment, you can have Ari's incredible food, you can have Joe's charisma up front, his family's oysters when they're in season. And then you're interacting with the back of house, which we thought was really important, and creates an environment where, like, you know, we know when our dishwasher is, like, washing more dishes, that person's making more money, which I think creates an environment where everybody wants the place to do well.
Sure.
And it creates energy, which is what makes places great.
Yeah, I mean, when this place is packed and being such an intimate spot, everyone feels that they're all in from back of the house to front of the house.
Yeah.
Sorry. No real front of the house, but your definition of a front of the house.
Exactly.
Joe, so you grew up in Orleans, Cape Cod, Massachusetts.
Correct. Yeah.
And you've been around oysters for a long stretch of your life. From the beginning of your life, did your parents always have the oyster farm? Or
no.
When did your parents start the oyster farm?
Like, 10 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
But growing up in the Cape, seafood goes hand in hand with that sort of upbringing.
For sure. I always tell people it's crazy. Like, we used to go to, like, the bar down the street, the Landho, or whatever place to eat, and it was never, like, a selection of oysters. It just said, oysters, this much money.
Yeah.
Like, I moved to Los Angeles, and all of a sudden, there was, like, different kinds of oysters, and I had no idea.
Yeah.
I get, you know, different kind of oysters, but, like, different names and different people's oysters, I had no idea, so that was, like, my favorite part of when we opened the Clam Shack. It was just, like, you know, or when we opened, you know, Found in general, we just had one oyster. I was like, this is great. And then we had two, and they were both from Cape Cod. And I was like, this is even better.
How does one get into oyster farming?
I mean, basically, on the Cape, I mean, it's different.
Sure.
In different places. But on the Cape, for instance, like, Wellfleet, which is a couple towns over, is, like, mm-hmm, the famous place.
Shout out.
Yeah. Which is where I grew up going every summer.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Man, I'm trying to choose my words and shout out everybody now.
It's fine. I'll punch you with a shout out.
I'm not going to name the towns I don't want to shout out.
Yeah.
No, but like Wellfleet had a time, you know, has had farms for a long time. And then from there, there's Dennis and Brewster, Barnstable, East Ham, all the way. And there's like tons of farms. And the state grants a farm. So we call them, like, we call it a grant. Because
mm-hmm.
The state grants you, let's say in our case, mom and dad in Orleans, a half acre to grow oysters on in the bay. Which the reason there hasn't been much in Orleans for a while, there are some in Pleasant Bay, which is on the other side near the ocean. But the reason there haven't been much on the bay side is because there's no protection there. It's mm-hmm. like very high current. It's like open ocean. The water's rushing through severe tides. Like
you feel
huge ass storms yeah. in the winter, like icebergs. It's gnarly. It's crazy. Yeah, but like Wellfleet is very much protected by Great Island.
One lucky SOBs to Wellfleet. You think you're better than me?
Well,
it's crazy. Like you go to the Bay Beach in Wellfleet, where I grew up going, and the water's still.
Oh,
you go out in Orleans, and it's you feel like you're at the ocean.
Yeah,
you don't realize you're on the bay.
And then does that lead to a different type of oyster?
Big time.
Yeah,
for sure. So I mean, first thing is that the more the oysters are in the water, the more they just gorge themselves and eat. And that's great. They grow faster. No one really knows, but there's that, like, oh, longer growing, slower growing, you know, faster growing, whatever, debate. But the one thing that is true is that an oyster that's sitting in the water for more time is just open longer, a little more brittle shell. Like, our oysters are basically working out every day, right? Like, the water goes away, they shut, and they're closing, their shell's getting harder. They're becoming like they're getting knocked around by
these things
current.
Are fully exposed how many hours a day? Six.
Probably
about
two
six.
Tides, 3 hours each time. So I mean they're getting knocked around by the water too, which is great. It's just kind of lucky that we're there. A lot of people take their oysters out of the water, put them in like almost like a mini cement mixing thing and tumble them around to kind of chip the ends so they grow deeper and to strengthen the oysters.
Got it.
I always think of it, it's like the Ivan Drago on the treadmill in Rocky with like all the pads on, but it's an oyster. But ours just kind of naturally get that. And it's not like I'm saying, oh, we just let it do. It's like, you know, my 70-year-old parent. Sorry, mom's 68.
Yeah, mom.
But no, like, she's not. She would not like you saying that. No. She's 51.
Nah, whatever. She's the best. But, like, they're not, we're not going to go out. We don't have the capacity to do those other things.
Right.
So we're just kind of letting
nature do its thing.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's not just like, oh, well, it has to be hands off. It's more like, this is all we can do, you know? Also,
yes.
Wellfleet, just quick shout out, Wellfleet, Dennis, those places, they can drive on the flats with their trucks.
Oh, yeah.
Mom and dad.
They're out there in
no
the way.
No dice in Orleans.
Yeah.
Dragging a cart.
There's a lot of old laws going on out there. You can't, like, yeah.
And Ari, you've been involved with seafood for the majority of your professional life, right?
Yeah.
Starting at legendary Providence in LA, straight out of culinary school. What drew you to seafood from more or less the get-go? What is it about it?
Well, you know, I guess it really started in my time growing up in Charleston.
Shout out.
Yeah, big shout out, man. Chucktown, represent.
Great oysters.
Amazing oysters.
Amazing oysters.
Really hard to get. We can get them out here, but they're so expensive.
Yeah.
Because no one else knows the value and the production's small. But hopefully one day we'll be able to get our hands on some of those guys. I grew up in a very seafood-heavy town, a lot of waterways, grew up fishing, grew up just kind of, you know, on the water in some sense, you know? With that said, I was a terrible eater.
Like,
I grew up hating food. Like, I really loved steak and potatoes. It's kind of good.
Which
chicken
is odd that you'd
too.
Be drawn to seafood, because that's probably the toughest hang
totally.
As far as being a picky eater.
Yeah, oh man.
Yeah.
I really didn't eat fish in general until I was like 18, until I moved out of my house and I started like cooking for myself. Started going out to some restaurants like on the West Coast, and I'd always been working in restaurants as a kid, you know, family friends restaurants. I started as a host when I was like 4'8". And like worked my way up into the kitchen, you know, washing dishes, and finally got the idea to go to culinary school. And the more that my palate developed, started eating more seafood, I really just enjoyed the nuance of the art of butchering it and the art of cooking. And that's kind of what drew me in. But I will say, the job at Providence was a total fluke. I really didn't even know what I was getting myself into. I was so young. And my first externship, which was supposed to be at this place called Norman's,
mm-hmm.
up on Sunset Boulevard, is Norman Van Aken's place.
Oh, yeah.
Back in the day.
Yep.
They like went under the week before I was supposed to go on my externship. And so I was scrambling. One of my teachers was like, "Hey, man, I'm going to do you a solid." And he got me the interview in Providence. And I'm like, you know, there for a couple weeks, and I'm really like starting to really like get the hang of it and looking around. And that's when I fully understood what I got myself into.
Yeah, I mean, that place is no joke.
Yeah, it was intense. But I'll be honest, like, you know, I got to go eat there a lot. And I think that's so important for young cooks to be able to eat where they cook, to really fully understand what's going on with the whole restaurant, not just the food, but the experience of the hospitality industry. And I will never forget my first meal at Providence. It was a 4-hour, you know, 20-course endeavor. And that's when it finally clicked for me. I was like, wow, I'm somewhere really special.
Yep.
And I'm going to stay here until I feel like, you know, I've hit a plateau of some sorts, you know? And I stayed there for on and off for almost 5 years.
It's amazing. And I know that you also spent time at Charleston, at Leon's, which is...
Yeah.
If you've never been, it's incredible. Fried chicken, oysters, it's great.
That place is an institution now, man. It's a beast.
It's a beast. And so with your three backgrounds and with Holly now having the space, how did you guys come together to create the restaurant that we're sitting in?
Yeah, I mean, I think what was interesting for us is we, after the absurdly long process of entitling the space and building it, we got hung up on our beer and wine license at the very end.
Shocker.
Right. So we were sitting here, the four of us, and just talking about, like, what are we going to do? We can't just, like, open an oyster bar without beer and wine. It's not really what we want to do. And we had, like, some different thoughts, and just suddenly I was like, we need to be way more creative and come up with, like, a concept and do it in here. And so we came up with this idea of the Clam Shack, right? Mm. And we were like, hey, you know, let's do the Clam Shack. What was it, Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
12 to 5.
12 to 5, right? Or 12 to 4,
yeah,
right? 12 to 5, 12 to 5. 12 to 5. So, and we just did 3 days a week, and we were like, let's just get in the space, get people in here, do it during the day so it doesn't feel as odd that you can't have a beer or wine. You know, we don't really want to launch found without, that's a major element of what we're doing here. And so we did a menu really inspired by Cape Cod.
Yeah, like you guys.
Yeah.
You know, what you grew up eating.
Yeah, it was really Cape Cod. And like, Harv's making clam chowder, and he's like, dude, like, he's never been to Cape Cod before. He's never had. He's yeah. like.
And he never will. It'll just ruin it.
Yeah.
He won't be as good.
Well, it's almost like that took, it was basically like, here's New England food on paper. Right?
Yeah.
Like, and then Ari just took that and made his recipes of that. And then like the scalloped tostada, we integrated some stuff of our own that like really was going to represent found. But, you know, it was, what was the menu? It was the fried oysters, broiled oysters.
Chowder.
Wedge. Wedge salad.
Clams.
Yeah.
Steamers, which no one does out here.
No one does steamers.
They're really a pain to get out here.
Lobster roll. And the only dish not to make it to here, coleslaw.
Hey, there's still time.
I'll be honest with you, man. It's not that I don't love coleslaw. It's that cabbage takes up so much room.
Yeah.
It has zero refrigeration.
Yeah, the whole space is 777 square feet.
But that was crazy, is that, like, rolling with that, there wasn't, like, we didn't have chowder on the menu.
No.
We didn't have a wedge salad on the menu. We didn't have fried oysters on the menu. Steamer cup. None of that was
We had, like, no staff when we did this.
And, too. Like, people came in, ate that stuff, and loved it. It was like, well, we should probably keep this on the menu.
And it started to be like, hey, there is definitely a Cape element, there's definitely a Charleston element, there's definitely like a Parisian wine bar element, and we were like, we're in Los Angeles, we don't have to be true to any of these places, right? We can just be ourselves, and that I think represents LA better than anything, which is people here from LA or from all over the world, you know, and that was, I think, really like the defining moment, was just like having to go through that process of doing the Clam Shack and being like, we don't have to be anything we don't want to be, we can just be ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because some will define oyster places as, like, Boston, you know, like Union, or San Francisco, like Swan Oyster. How did you guys filter it and decide to keep filtering as something that takes the best of both coasts?
You know, I mean, I think that it's something that just kind of naturally occurred. We are very fortunate to work with a lot of great suppliers.
Yeah.
That are giving us some amazing sustainable seafood. And honestly, a lot of the menu has been made up about what we can get our hands on and what, you know, what we want to use. And once again, super lucky to be in that position to be able to make those decisions off of that rather than like, you know, oh, well, this is Los Angeles, so we need a bunch of vegetables. And like, I mean, to be honest, like, it's a very protein heavy place.
Yeah.
We've got a wedge salad. We've got what? We've got a
leeks.
We've got leeks.
Yeah.
You know, and
also as a vegetable.
But didn't make the menu.
About that later.
Well, I think too, right? 26 seats lets you do just what you want to do, mm-hmm. right? Because you're going to find the group. Like, we're very clear about who we are, and so I think people come in here knowing enough about us that the clientele we have here has been. I mean, we've had crazy repeat guests. People come in like 6-7 times in the first 8 weeks, and people know they're coming here for seafood. And so I think we have most people here, and like, no matter what these guys are special on that night, like if it's razor clams, we're going to sell razor clams. Like if it's live scallops, they're going to sell. Like that is what's been so fun is source it and then they'll fuck it up.
And there's people on Instagram.
Right. Story of my life.
People come in, they're like, how do I know? Like, I messaged 5 people on Instagram, like, hey, we have razor clams tonight. Because like, I told them I would.
And oh, really?
So excited about when razor clams come.
That's good GM job.
Yeah, like thanks.
That's nice. That's sweet.
We're going to take a quick break. We're going to talk about more of the restaurant, more of the oysters, and then what it means to be a new restaurant here in LA.
Cool.
We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Can you hear the sound of the waves? I can hear from here. I think I made it. Got another several weeks of this mayhem. It's a rat city. It's a luxury. Gonna call old Kelly and ask her for $1,000. She's a future woman on the $20 bill. Naked, her breast exposed, just a little bit scared. While the Midwest looks, what will I be? Who will I be? Kiwi meat, will I stay on fleek or flee back to the city? Got a couple of questions about the last 10-odd years. First one, was I there? Did we use the time we all had wisely? Did we squander it? Celebrating everything, posing. Fearing loneliness, growing bitter, or working. Or upgrade status someday, oh, what could it be? What neighborhood, a high-rise with a view, or a cottage in the countryside? How to prepare for a major change? Start selling, packing weeks in advance. Would you cry, yawned it last night, comforted by your courage? Would you notify a black Irish goodbye? We ain't playing. We leave in. Catch you on the flip side. Da 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 da. Can you hold the train doors open for a little longer? 'Cause I'm coming. Had to drop the keys off, sweep into a dummy check. Paid my tab, square up with my bankroll friends. I get the feeling this is not unusual. Waving goodbye to the ghetto birds. Must be time for the show. First to compliment the millennials. It's your time to do the dance. Your tongue knot up, and you say I do, send a shout out. All the freelance freaks doing Lord's work, making major moves. To the garbage men, to the barkeeps, to the up all nighters, the 9-to-5ers. How to prepare for a major change. Start selling, packing weeks in advance. Would you cry on your last night? Comforted by your courage, would you notify a black Irish goodbye? We ain't playing. are we leaving? I'll catch you on the flip side.
Hello and welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Darren Bresnitz. We're here with Joe, Ari, and Adam. And we'll shout out Holly, too.
Yeah. Shout out.
Shout out.
Shout out.
I found an oyster here in LA. So, opening up a new restaurant in Los Angeles, I feel like something pops up every week. But nothing has really opened up like this. Like, this is not another, like, new American farm-to-table type of restaurant. So, how have you gone about educating the public or the press about who you are, what you're about, without them putting their own, you know, their own prejudices on it or, like, their own thoughts on it, especially because if you've never been to an oyster bar, like, if you didn't grow up on the Northeast Coast or even the East Coast, you may have never experienced a restaurant like this.
Yeah, I think a lot of it started from the very beginning, even when we were designing this place, right? And, like, Holly and I, Holly was amazing, really drove all the design and built this place. But it was, like, we wanted it to feel very personal, right? So that it didn't just feel like another template, which that, I think, comes down to, in many ways, just like sourcing seafood, you're sourcing design, right? Like, go out and find things and materials that are from vintage shops or antique malls or, like, you found from your travels and that have real personality, right? And two, well, I think maybe one of the smartest decisions we made in terms of design was not doing a marble bar, right? Which is like on the West Coast, a lot of times, especially in LA, when people hear oyster bar, they imagine marble and champagne, right? And we went wood, which is...
East Coast too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot, yeah, New York especially.
Maison Premier, you know.
Totally.
Who I love.
Amazing.
But that is a classic when I think of New England, Northeast.
Exactly. But like you go to Cape Cod, there's no marble.
No.
Tops, right? It's like, you know, our friends that like drive cement trucks go, I mean, oysters and do seafood. And like a plant, like this is all very blue collar there. Right?
Sure.
And so we knew we wanted an element of that blue collar part of it, which we think is casual and makes people comfortable, right? And with that, I think some of the early decisions we had is we know to source this quality of seafood, we were going to have to charge a certain amount, right? Like, it costs as much as it costs. But to balance that, we were like, we need a $5 beer on the menu, right? We need a glass of wine that you can get for 10 bucks or less. Like, there were ways, I think, to make the concept approachable in that way, that from the beginning were really the framework for what we were trying to accomplish, so that, like, it didn't feel like a place where it was inattainable, especially in East Hollywood. Like, this is a really diverse community, especially economically. And we wanted to make it so that if you wanted to come in and get a cup of chowder and a beer, you could experience this place very differently than someone who wanted to come and do a huge shellfish platter and do those special razors and drink champagne. And you can do that here. You can either throw down or you can come in and, like, have it as an afternoon hang, even if you don't have a lot of capital.
Yeah, I mean, Joe, it sort of goes back to you growing up about having this idea of just a oyster instead of going to these restaurants where even if you know seafood, I mean, Ari, you know as well, it's like you can have a dozen choices and it feels very intimidating. But the great thing about your oyster is that it also has a familial tie and a location tie. So I'd love for you to talk about, like, what does it represent to you to be able to serve your parents' oysters on the other side of the country and make that connection to back home?
I mean, it's crazy. It's wild. I feel very much there, like, most of the time I'm here. And, like, it goes as far as, like, we get the oysters in, and, like, I'm, like, unloading the bags. If I wash off, you know, like, rinse off the oysters, put them on, and I, like, get one of the bags, and it's, like, whirled up a bunch and tied all annoyingly. I'm like, okay, Dad, settle down. You know, Mom will do it just fine and nice, but, like, you know, Dick is, like, super over-aggressive with the, like, I can just see him, like, flinging the bag around and tying it through, and, but it's a huge connection, and, like, you know, my parents find it, like, amazing, super cool, slightly hilarious.
Joanne was in the like,
yeah, yeah, she's pumped. I mean, they're like, we all find it so funny. Like, you know, it was really tiny. It's a half acre. We had a tiny amount of oysters to start. And now, you know, we're pushing numbers, kind of. You know, we're selling through a good wholesaler now, and the restaurant is certainly responsible for that in some point. I mean, I used that to get on that wholesaler's roster.
That's amazing,
and it's like really big for them. They can sell their oysters where you know, on Cape Cod, there's a lot of oysters being grown. It gets really tough to sell your oysters, especially in the fall and heading into the winter. But it means a ton, and it's really awesome. It's just like I eat one of those oysters, and it's like, boom. Because I grew up, like, you know, the oysters are like a half mile offshore. I grew up, like, you know, another half mile or so, maybe more, from there. So it's like
1 mile.
It's exactly where I grew up, and it's like a lot of nostalgia tied in.
Well, the whole idea too of miroir, right? That like oysters are, the taste is influenced by place, just like with wine, and like that, because that's still why I love having Cape oysters. When I have a Cape oyster, I feel a sense of nostalgia that brings me, like, I'm at the beachcomber with my feet in the sand, and I'm like 12 years old. You know what I mean? Like those things.
But that's not. I mean, when we don't have mom and dad's oysters, I think that's the best part. Actually, some people come in now and say we'll take a dozen family. And I'm
God.
That's like, amazing.
And they have six mom and dads. Tight.
So, and in addition to the oysters, you've gotten a lot of really good early press. The LA Times just came out with a great piece on the oysters, a place in the food itself, which has got to be awesome to only be open for a few months.
Thank you, LA Times.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Shout out.
What's it been like, you know, Ari, especially for you, who has, you know, cooked like Providence and cooked around LA at all these famous restaurants, to see that early press, and how does it inspire you for like what you've done, but also keep you pushing?
I mean, first and foremost, certainly truly humbled by, you know, those words. It's certainly a lot of validation, and also just, you know, really, really great to see that we connected with a lot of people in that way, that they get what we're doing. It's super important. So, you know, honestly, being written up in the LA Times for me was a dream I had as a 21-year-old kid working in Providence.
Sure.
This is something that's now been fully, like, you know, realized in that way, and it feels really fucking good.
Yeah.
Not gonna lie.
No, and it shouldn't. It's okay to have dreams, and when you hit those dreams, to be like, take that moment, recognize 100%. It. But then also go, how do we keep up that momentum, right?
Well, to be honest, like, the biggest thing for me, and what, you know, it's only been a week now, but the thing that I'm coming to is that since people understand exactly what we're doing, it allows for us to do so much more.
Fair.
And that's really exciting, because I get to dig deeper and look harder to find products that we can use and are sustainable and, you know, prepare them in simple ways for people to enjoy. And it's things that you don't, like, the razor clams are kind of, I mean, we talked about steamers earlier, but those razor clams, too, you're not really getting something like that much of anywhere in the city.
There's just not that many.
It's
not that many in the city on any given day, like, to get access to.
Yeah.
What type of sustainable products do you have offered to you, if not in the California coast, but on the West Coast, that maybe someone from the East Coast has never had? You know, is it, like, whelks or other types of mollusks and things like that?
It's actually a lot of fish, especially in California. There's a lot of black cod and rockfish out here. You know, it's actually much more humble things than
spiny lobster.
East Coast, but exactly. The spiny lobster is a big one. But we have that in Florida.
Fair.
Rather than the Caribbean.
Oh, yeah.
They're way more colorful.
Yeah.
But, you know, the sea urchin is a huge one.
Santa Barbara.
There's stuff in Boston, in Mass, but it's very different.
Yeah, I mean, the sea urchin here is probably one of our best offerings. And so to let people know that what you're doing, what is that?
Small prawns are another one, too.
What does that allow you to do, knowing that you don't even have enough room for coleslaw? Yeah. Controversial question.
Yeah.
Well, but, like, you know, it's you have a certain amount of space, so people are going to, right? So, like, I see you on Instagram. I read the article. I want to come in, and in my mind, I want to have a certain type of experience, which the space allows for.
Right.
But then you also want to push. Where do you find that balance?
Good question. You know, I mean, I think really what we've been slowly doing is just developing the menu itself to carry enough weight that even for some reason, God forbid, we don't have a special on that day, someone can come in, order off the, you know, basic found menu and have that experience, right? And it's, you know, something that we've been working on building since day one. We're still adding dishes to that menu slowly, but, you know, finding these things that are crucial to the experience, putting them on there, making sure that we can get that done every day. That's the baseline, right? And then the rest is just cream. The rest is fun.
Yeah.
And we're figuring out how to order things in a way that we're not overwhelming our refrigerator so it doesn't ice over and die.
Yeah.
And we, you know, and to be honest, especially with the product we're working with, it's great because we're just turning it over. Things sure. don't hang out here long.
No, yeah, they can't.
No,
they can't.
It goes really fast. I think, you know, too, like getting exposure like from the LA Times, right, where I think what was amazing about that article is that it really felt like, I think, you know, Bill wrote like a refuge and a party. We were like, that's what exactly we wanted to do. And then there was a line about champagne and Coors Banquet. And I was like, if, you know, like if we wanted someone to describe like what, how you'd use this place, like this was, yeah, it was comprehended. And so I think it's like the basic rule, I think, of all restaurants is deliver exactly what it is that you promise, right? Mm-hmm. And like if you have a sign on your door and it says like shitty pizza and cheap ass beer, you'll find your crowd as long as you have pizza and cheap ass beer, right?
That place sounds great.
It's probably great. Yeah, it's
yeah,
awesome.
That place sounds great.
But if you had said at the same time like amazing pizza and craft beer and you don't have that, then you're going right. to disappoint people. And here from the very beginning, we're just like, we're a seafood place, we're fun, we're casual, we're a bar. So I think when they come in and suddenly, you know, these guys are serving like live scallops that day or sardines that just came in like that morning that still are like in full rigor mortis, they're so excited to experience that, that like they're willing to come and like, you know, wait a little while to get a seat just to hope like what, you know, what's the seafood going to be today?
People go for the specials constantly for yeah. the whole time.
Well, I think you know when it's fresh and there's a certain trust established that I may have never had this type of fish or I don't know the preparation. Because when I came here and I'd never really had a ton of escabeche in my life.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah. and I was like, oh, this is awesome. This is fantastic. But you just go like, I trust that with this small of a menu that if they're going to put something on there, it's got to be holding its weight.
Totally.
But it's also nice to see, you know, to talk about what you talked at the beginning, that to have an idea of what this place you want to be in your mind, and then people get it, especially at like a Bill Addison level.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything better out there, like for anyone who like has any creative desire to like do something, that when you put something out in the world and somebody describes it back to you the way you envisioned yeah. it, like that is the greatest sense of like, just like, it's humbling, but it really is, you know, Ari's point, like it just feels amazing. It really does.
So with being open for a few months and looking to the future, what have you guys already learned and how are you taking that into the next foreseeable months and years of running this restaurant?
We're already rebuilding this place.
Yeah, we're trying to figure out how to get people a drink while they wait.
Yeah. I mean, like, from the beginning, we've definitely, like, we're the kind of operators that, like, oh, there's not enough shelving over here? Okay, boom. Like, by the next day, we'll build a shelf.
Or, right.
Like, we'll have our mill worker come in and, like, come up with all new solutions. So, really, it's figuring out. We think we want to expand wine program. We know we want to expand raw bar, right?
Yeah.
We know we want to make sure the experience stays engaging as we get busier and busier and that people really feel acknowledge like the second they get in here and that they're taken care of until they leave, right?
I think the biggest discussions every day are actually how do we serve people better?
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
like how are we going to make sure that everyone is going to have that experience, you know, because it is only 26 seats and, you know, any percentage of people that we've failed is a big deal, you know?
Yeah, it is.
Especially if you're waiting.
Especially if you're hanging,
which is tough. Which is really tough, and you can see everyone who's waiting either in the bar area or outside.
Yeah, you do. You do.
You know what, though? People are happy to be here. And
yeah.
Just with, let's say, like, we have two people sitting here because there's no other table, then a four top moves in, and there's, like, a corner at the bar, and, like, you're like, hey, do you mind moving over here to the bar so I can seat this big party? And people just get up, bring their wine glass, move over there. They feel like it's... Everybody knows each other. You know, it's like a party in here.
Yeah, there's a bit of a...
Steal Bill's words.
And a refuge.
Yeah.
And a refuge.
I think when you go to a place like this, you sort of enter into a specific type of social contract.
Yeah.
That, like, this only works if we all work together.
Yeah, totally.
People are so happy.
Oh,
you're
yeah.
down or...
We've got to navigate this place. When you're running food in this restaurant,
yeah.
like, it's Tetris. You're Tetrising yourself across the restaurant.
Big time. I mean, those are the discussions the whole time. It's like, all right, well, if those three people get up there and we get this two top and move down, we can move that table here and we can sit.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the first rule of this restaurant is never just turn around because you're going to bump. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
If you got to, like, go back the other way, you need to, like, turn your head, look really carefully, make sure you can turn back the other way. You're going to crush somebody.
Awesome. Well, listen, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. If people want to find the restaurant in real life and online, where can they go?
Foundoyster.com.
Cool. cool.
You can go on Instagram at Found Oyster. You can go to the corner of Fountain and Edgemont, west of Vermont, south of Sunset.
And where's the valet?
Valet.
We had a neighborhood valet that just was lost.
Ouch. All right, well, breaking news here on Snacky Tunes. Well, thank you guys so much. Congratulations. We have another song for the archives and then a live band from the archives, or maybe live in real life. We'll see what happens when this comes out here on Snacky Tunes on heritageradionetwork.org.
Like nothing's wrong.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2 Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. I'm here with Lou and Ben, who make up Winston's. Welcome, boys.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Really good to have you in
the
studio.
Very glad to be here.
Yeah. So how did you make it to Brooklyn from Virginia?
By car,
I-95
north. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you stop? Did you take any scenic routes?
Yeah, I think we stopped at Walt Whitman on the New Jersey Turnpike.
Yeah, it's my favorite.
Did you go direct? Some people will, I mean, it's not much of a road trip, but did you turn any of it into a road trip?
We have. We've done that corridor
a lot.
A lot.
What's the secret?
Timing.
Go fast.
Not hit the beltway in D.C. around rush hour. That'll add 3 hours.
Okay, fair.
That's pretty practical. Moving up here, I used to have a Ford Ranger pickup, and I totally tortoiseshell. It was like I looked like a snail. I pretty much had everything I owned and was bringing and just put like 3 tarps over it and totally Beverly Hillbilly styled it with duct tape and tarps and everything I owned under it and moved up here in a day and got here at like midnight. And
what brought you up here, or what forced you out of Virginia?
I met a girl playing a show up here and decided I was going to move
classic,
to New York City.
Classic story. Where's the girl?
She's at home right now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with her 2 stepcats.
Oh, okay. Is she with you?
Uh-huh.
Oh, amazing. That story doesn't... I mean, I feel like the New York story is just like, met a girl, where's the girl? Doesn't matter.
Ben, how's your girl? What happened to her?
I have the same exact story.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you both met girls that... Was that the same show or was it different?
Oh, okay. Yeah, not the same exactly.
No, we were playing with different people. We didn't know each other until we lived in Brooklyn.
Oh, okay.
But we were living in the same city in Virginia.
Yeah, we spent a long time in
Are you both from Virginia?
I was born and raised in Richmond.
Okay.
Yeah.
I grew up in New Hampshire and then lived in Virginia for 10 years.
So did the band form because you had similar partner stories, or how did you guys get together?
I think we were both kind of starting over in terms of music, having relocated here by ourselves independently.
Because you have 2 different backgrounds, right? Lou, you're into country and bluegrass, and Ben, you've got jazz horn?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's how I grew up. I learned how to play music playing tenor saxophone.
Okay.
So... drums is still an indomitable task for me, but easy after like doing like those kind of chord changes and trying to solo over it. I was like, oh, I get to hit things now. Great.
I mean, you've pared it down to a snare, a brass, a tambo, and a kick drum.
Yeah, there's still metal involved.
There's still metal on board. And how were you convinced to put down the sax and pick up the stick?
Oh, it's easier to play with people, and that's kind of what happened with us. It was like, hey, you want to jam sometime, and then it worked really well and made us both happy, so.
No one was, like, begging for a sax player in a Brooklyn band?
No.
And then for for your background of country and bluegrass?
I grew up playing cello and guitar when I was little, and then picked up banjo as a teenager and then got paid for the first time to play music playing banjo, being like a banjo side man.
What was the gig?
A guy I knew in college who had a band asked me to join his buddy's band, filling it out with like a fiddle player and a banjo player.
Was it a Dave Matthews or Bela Fleck cover band?
No, it wasn't. It was pretty traditional, pretty old. There's a huge amount of, I mean, that's we were in Charlottesville, which is like kind of Appalachia adjacent, and everybody grew up playing, and all their daddies play and all their granddaddies play, and there's so many unbelievable musicians around there. And there's every corner bar has a Cracker Jack bluegrass band.
Got it. What was it? Do you remember the name of the band?
The first time I got paid $40 to play in Joe Mama's pajamas one night at the Gravity Lounge. Wow. Yeah, it wasn't my band. I didn't name it. I didn't sing.
Gravity Lounge is now a CBS, in case you're curious.
I am. That's sad. Yeah. That's sad.
Common tale.
Yes, it is.
And how long did you play the banjo before you kind of swapped over to a guitar and started writing your own music?
I formed a band probably 2 or 3 years after that, and started writing songs and playing songs I'd written. Still playing banjo and doing kind of a heavier rock and roll, mountain rock and roll type thing. And then
what is mountain rock and roll?
It was something we made up because it was bluegrass with drums and electric guitars. And and then just got kind of just tired of playing bluegrass. Got tired of playing banjo. Just got really wasn't good enough to be nuts about it. Wasn't that super into the really technical stuff. Had always grown up playing guitar and was more comfortable with it. So after getting paid to play banjo for a while, I figured maybe I could just play guitar and do more with it.
What is the most surprising thing about playing banjo that an uninitiated person wouldn't know that makes it so difficult or hard to master?
It's just so much right hand. It's so much finger picking. I mean, you can play it a bunch of different ways, and a lot of people do really. There's like claw hammer and there's three finger style, and some people just strum it or play it like a guitar. I was really into Lester Flatt and doing the three finger style, and I used to sit on the couch with the TV remote in my left hand and just do rolls with my finger picks with my right hands for hours and hours and hours. It's just muscle memory.
Okay.
Building that up.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah.
What are you guys going to play for us first?
This is called Enough. It's the B-side of a 7-inch we put out February 17th on Warhen Records and Grand Jury Records.
Great. Here live on Snacky Tunes.
Shame of watching someone enough. Love should be enough. Love, true love should be enough.
I want to read a question that you guys sent over to me before the show. Salad, what's the deal?
What's the deal with salad?
What's the deal with salad?
I put everything in it these days.
I know.
I think it's just they everybody's trying to get rid of bread, so they're just making big sandwiches and calling them salads.
They're just like, this is a salad. You're like, it's a pound and a half. I think you've missed the point.
Yeah. As long as you leave the bread out,
it's fine. Salad. It's just salad. So you work over at Greenpoint Fish and Lobster.
I do. I wait tables over there since they open.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh.
Those boys are great. We've worked with them in the past.
It's a great institution.
What is a fan favorite over there of yours? What is probably one of the more underrepresented menu items?
The fish sandwich with french fries.
It's the best.
It's killer.
It's the best. I feel like it's one of the best deals in Greenpoint.
Yeah, it's certainly not the thriftiest thing happening.
Other than a dollar Jello shot at Capri Lounge.
Fine. Ooh. That yeah, okay. That, I mean, I think we're in two different worlds at that point. Yes, nothing could be. Actually, my friend had a surprise birthday party there, and just cleared out the Jello shots, and it was like $22, and everyone was just done.
They make for the best mornings.
Yeah, I mean, I can't believe like
you drink them in the morning. Is that what you mean?
Like you put it in your pocket. Morning. The next, yeah, like, just, sure. It's like a to go. It's the only to go type of cup you can get.
Bathtub of Jello shots.
Bathtub of Jello shots. I mean, I wonder where in the hierarchy of Capri are you making Jello shots? Is it at the beginning? Like, is that, or you work your way up because it's such a backbone, iconic staple there? It's like no. Only Samantha makes the Jello shots.
I mean, sure. I think it'd be a lauded position as the 6 p.m. slurp. Whoever gets a taste test, that jungle juice.
I don't know. I watched most of Crocodile Dundee in there the other night with commercial breaks.
I mean, the place, if you haven't been, it's probably one of the, like, the last havens of best dive bars in Greenpoint.
That's a good one. There's a couple. Conio's is mine, if you've ever been there.
Ah, I've never. Where's that?
It's right around the corner from me.
It's
under
Norman. His house. It's in the basement.
It's pretty much under my house.
It's the sign outside my bedroom door. Yes. It's called Conio's.
It's terrific. Yeah. If you go there, say hey to Barbara for me. Or Lou said hello. I'll tell her myself.
You guys have a recording project in the Financial District.
Yeah, we were there all day yesterday.
What's the setup and why the Financial District?
A friend of ours who's a producer had been had taken an interest in what we were up to next, and we said, let's work with you in his room. It's called Full Tone Studios, and it's on Fulton.
No, you didn't have to say that. No, we got it. But for the people not in New York, yeah.
It's fun down there. It's interesting. I got into the elevator yesterday at noon with an 18-pack of Miller Lite, and all the construction dudes were in there, and I was like, I couldn't find the door to the basement, and they were like, oh, come to the elevator. I walk in, the door closes, and they push 10. And then they all just cracked up at my expense. You know, it's worth it.
And is it one of those things, like, before 5, you can't really do anything, but after 5, it's just kind of no noise problems, no nothing?
It's in the basement. I don't think there's much down there except for... they have a couple mouser cats in the hallways.
Yeah.
But there's not much going on otherwise. But it's just a big room. We're a two-piece, so we like to use all the air, try not to, like, segment too much. We don't need a lot of space, but we were there for 10 hours yesterday tracking for...
What are you guys working on?
Just always keep working. We just put out a 7-inch. We're thinking our next project is probably going to be a full-length. So we just did a day in the studio, and we don't know what we have yet, but we'll see, and just keep every couple of weeks we'll book some studio time.
And the 7-inch came out, and you mentioned it before, in Grand Jury and Warhen Records. So how did you hook up with them, and why a 7-inch?
We had two songs that we really liked. So we put it on a piece of wax. Yeah, Warren is Luke's buddy from Charlottesville for a long time. Real good dude. He used to do production at the Jefferson, which is like the biggest...
it's a big theater down there.
Yeah, it's nice.
And he had this boutique 7-inch label. So we had been touring. We did two southern trips last summer touring, and we were coming back from one and booked some studio time at a small studio where I used to live that a buddy of mine runs. And so we just went in and recorded for 2 days because we before we came back to New York. And then started some of those tracks around. He wanted to put it on a 7-inch, and then we and Grand Jury wanted to put it out digitally.
Yeah, Craig and Robbie saw us open for Esme Patterson at Mercury Lounge, and we're like, hey. And we went on tour with her later that summer.
And so you're like, hey again.
Yeah, we said hey back.
It was super convenient. The run started in Dallas.
Oh, okay.
At some point someone said yo or sup.
Sup. And then they just like slid a piece of paper with a shot of two shots of bourbon next to it, and that's how it goes.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
Yeah. Can we hear another song?
Plied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What are you gonna play for us?
It's a song called Heaven's Full of Mules. We haven't put it out yet, but we've tracked it and probably will put it out.
Perfect.
Not too long.
Okay, here live on Snacky Tunes.
I'll start again. Selling off my days to pay for more that are still in store for me. I'll punch the clock tomorrow, bow before my boss who can take away my needed pay if she wants. I've heard how lucky I am making honest wage, not worth a damn to anyone just enjoying. Heaven full of mules.
of mules.
Winston's are quoted as saying, wearing the band t-shirt to the band is a new power move. Explain.
Yeah.
It's my friend Najla. She's a gym.
We've had a couple of those. We like it.
Yeah.
It's undoing years of the opposite.
Right. No, we got a buddy, Fernando, who came to our release show. And by the time we started, with the first time those t-shirts were available, he had purchased one, put it on, and was in the front row.
Better story about Fernando, not to try and one-up you, is that on New Year's Eve, Fernando proposed to his lady during our set. She said yes.
Congratulations, yeah. Fernando. Was he wearing the shirt?
He was by himself at the... No, he didn't have the shirt yet. And he was by himself when he had the shirt, but I think they're still... I don't know.
I mean, January's not that... It's not that far away. It's not that far.
No. Not that far. No, I think all is well.
Yeah.
But he... that is the new power move. We're buying the brand new band t-shirt, putting it on, and going to the front row.
Just so they know that you're a fan. Not just because you're there, but you're there for them.
Yes.
Right. It does feel good.
Yeah.
It's undeniable.
It definitely feels good, especially if you're not the headliner. So they know that they came for you.
Oh, yeah.
Like, boy, do we love not being the headliner.
We were headlining that night, though.
Oh, okay.
Unfortunately.
Apologies. Yeah. So just Fernando, the t-shirt.
We should have not headlined our own release show. That would have been the real power move.
That is a real power. Actually, that is a real power move.
Maximum humility.
I think you play second to last. So you're the peak.
That's cool. And then you have
someone else.
The after party.
That's the after party.
Mm.
We've had that move before, haven't we? I don't know.
How many releases have you had?
Three.
As many as I can get.
Three.
Yeah.
Oh, in clear plastic masks. Our first tape, we had an after party. It was clear plastic masks.
Okay.
We were arguably the support for that.
For your own release party.
Okay.
Arguably. That's fine.
So now you're tracking, but any tours coming up, hitting the road?
We're going back down to Virginia at the end of this month and playing some shows down there.
Yeah, we're going to go play our buddy Gold Connections release at the Southern in Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to play most of our stuff around.
They're going to release on Fat Possum.
Yeah.
And we're going down there for that, and we're going to be in Jersey, right? And...
Yeah, Jersey. Philadelphia.
Philadelphia.
All the dirty towns.
Yeah, Jersey, Philly. Not Pittsburgh.
Probably Harrisonburg again.
Harrisonburg, Virginia. Richmond, Virginia.
We played a wonderful open mic in Harrisonburg.
Were you booked in for the open mic,
yeah.
Or did you just stop by?
We were special guests.
We had a night off, but then we got paid and fed and...
It was
drank.
It was.
I mean, maybe I don't understand the concept of open mic, but how did you get booked for an open mic?
It was open, but you know, other random people.
No, somebody dropped out, right? And then we hopped on. We had a night off on the road. We had nothing better to do, and something fell in our lap. We took it. It was great.
I think it was the best show I've ever played.
Ever.
It's the best. It's the best open mic you've ever played.
Harrisonburg, Virginia, Clementines.
Yeah, best open mic.
No, it's Ruby's. It was downstairs.
Ruby's is downstairs,
and it's now a Duane Reade.
No, tell me that.
Well, I want to get one last question in, or more of a statement before you guys take us out.
Mm-hmm.
Sent from the band, eggs. They're just not for breakfast anymore. Discuss.
I eat eggs for every meal.
Yeah.
And my cholesterol is happy.
I'll get a dozen eggs and I'll like hard boil half of them and just save them in the fridge for
just because.
Just a quick, healthy snack.
Put an egg on anything, man.
Right? You could. You could put an egg on anything.
You could put it on a salad.
Ice cream.
You could call this egg by itself a salad.
Yeah, you could.
The classic trump card for you can put something on anything is ice cream. And vanilla ice cream with an egg on top, I think, with some salt, would be really good.
Wow.
Okay. Egg ice cream.
Breaking boundaries.
Well,
just you guys wait.
We're going to make sure you guys have time for one more song. Where can people find you, get the 7-inch, find out updates, catch you on tour, catch you at open mics?
Winston's band. Everything. @.com, www.
Yeah, everything's Winston's band.
There's an S in there that people can't hear.
Winston's. Band. .com / Winston's band.
Perfect.
And no article. Never, ever an article. No the.
Or That's just inappropriate.
Yeah, it's inappropriate.
Yeah, well, I mean, it would
or
counteract.
These. We could be these Winstons.
These Winstons. It would counteract all rooms of grammar and leave one of you out.
From now on, we shall be known as these Winstons.
That's pretty good.
Band.com.
What are you going to take us out with?
This is a song. Can you mildly curse on this?
Yes.
It's called Goddamn Goodbye.
You're fine. Well, thanks everyone for being on the show today. We'll be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. Take us out.
Thanks so much, listeners. Yeah, there's a new one. We haven't put it out anywhere yet, I don't think. But we will. We will. We're putting it out right now. Out of the universe.
Program is powered by Simplecast.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.